B.C., associated with the Institute for Research and Environment of the Faculty of Graduate Studies. Dr. Les Lavkovich is the director of the Institute, and a native of Alberta, he came to UBC after being educated in Alberta and at Cornell. Over the last 20 years, he has been instrumental in developing the strong interdisciplinary graduate program in resource management and environmental studies at UBC, which is now over 80 students. His own research has focused on particles and soil processes, including work related to mine reclamation and BC's coastal forests. Dr. Hans Schreier is a Swiss native with degrees from English and American universities, as well as UBC. His teaching and research has emphasized land use and water quality in watershed analysis. He has been involved in research projects all over the world, including Asia, South America, and the Middle East. And he has been associated with a long-running project in Nepal. The topic of our speaker's presentation tonight is a little closer to home. Indeed, it's one of immediate and pressing concern. It is Walkerton. Could it happen here? Need it happen here? Professors Lavkovich and Schreier.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone this evening. Usually at the beginning of the Institute lectures, the speakers normally make a witty remark. I don't make witty remarks. I don't have very much wit. But we are very pleased to be here this evening to speak on a topic that is very important, we feel, both to us and to all of you and everyone on the globe. Water is not only a resource, it's a vital necessity for life as we know it on this earth. We tend to take it for granted, yet we know that it's very important locally, provincially, nationally, and indeed globally. It is something that we often take for granted and simply do not worry about the fact because it is a common resource. The topic we were asked to speak on is Walkerton, which has been in the news to a considerable extent over the last several months. And this, of course, has happened in over a year ago, actually in May of 2000, so it's almost 2 years ago. The question is, can it happen here? The answer we've given tentatively is yes. The second question, does it need to happen? The answer is no. The third question is, will it happen? Probably. Now maybe we can go home. We can ask the question, what happened? As I've indicated, what is water? Water is a public good. It's a common pool resource, something that we all use, very important. In fact, we cannot live without it. Yet we don't care about how we use our water. It's typically the tragedy of the commons, important, but nobody owns it, so we don't care. Why? Why don't we care? What happened at Walkerton? Simply is the fact that we have a lack of communication and interconnectedness between what nature provides and our human institutions. There's a lack of communication. What happened in Walkerton? Walkerton, a nice little rural town in Bruce County in Ontario, central Ontario, an area characterized by farming, rolling hills, small towns, pleasant neighborhoods, residential areas, a place noted in Ontario for its livestock production, a place where water supply comes from groundwater, like in many other places, rural Canada, an area where one well possibly got contaminated. All government regulations, guidelines, as far as we can understand, were in place, and yet we had a disaster. What happened in Walkerton? In April of 2000, there was a long period of dry weather in Walkerton. This was followed by a large rainfall on the 12th of May, a long period of dry, warm weather when everything was growing beautifully. A storm occurred, causing runoff. The well water was safe prior to the 12th of May, as far as we know, and something happened on the 12th or so of May when the well water, well number 5, became contaminated after this storm with a little bacillus called E. coli. A normal chlorination had been suspended just prior to this rainfall event. What was the result? I'm sure you've all heard. 7 people died. Several thousand were seriously ill, and countless number of people have some sort of damage, some feel that is permanent health damage. In one day following the 15th of May, over 1% of the residents of 5,000 approximately in Walkerton contacted the local hospital emergency ward. In a matter of a few days, about 10% of the population of Walkerton contacted various kinds of hospitals and emergency wards. On the slide you see before you, on the right-hand side, is the farm that is supposedly the culprit for contaminating the water supply. The animals on that particular farm had been tested for E. coli and had passed government tests. Above lot 18, there's a stream which drains that particular area. And lot 20 and lot 21 was where manure had been spread in April, just prior to the major rainfall event on May the 12th. And you'll see that well 5 is on your right-hand side, the bottom part of the screen, and this received the contaminated runoff from the very severe storm. And the storm actually had about 140 millimeters of rain, 70 millimeters of rain in one rainfall event, causing surface runoff. And this was the public response to what happened after the event in Walkerton. Why? And you've all heard about the number of reasons, and we'd like to blame. We ask questions. Was it human error? Was it mismanagement? Was it a lack of monitoring? Was it government cutbacks? Was it a privatization of laboratories? Lack of education and training? Lack of knowledge? Was it institutional failure? I guess the answer is yes, all of them. And that was a problem.
Now, when we deal with water, particularly groundwater, we usually think about groundwater as a bit of a mystery because we can't see it. But we can drill nice boreholes into the ground and pump out the water, and we think it's pretty good, but we really don't know what's going on below the surface. Now, if you look at this under dry conditions, you can see that we have a lot of material which we dispose of at the surface of the soil, and if it's dry, this material probably doesn't move very far. However, once it gets wet, this material moves down and moves in all kinds of peculiar ways, which we have troubles tracing. What happens under wet conditions, you can see that if this particular well here was safe and nothing happened, but this particular well had some contamination, during wet conditions, one can go into the other. The big problem we have is microorganisms, particularly E. coli. And E. coli is a common microorganism in the digestive tract of most animals and human beings. And although it's normally not infectious, under certain conditions, it can flourish quite rapidly. And under those some conditions, it can be pathogenic, but it's relatively easy to measure. So what typically happens is you have a substrate, and here you have the bacterial activity, and these organisms can duplicate in about 20 minutes. So you can very rapidly reach a high population growth, and then, of course, problems start. what are the optimum conditions for these organisms to grow? Well, they need minerals and nutrients like you do. They need energy, organic matter, and of course they need water and oxygen. And only when all these three conditions are optimum do you actually get bacteria to flourish. So they can be dormant for a long period of time, but when conditions are right, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose.
What you see on the screen is a simple model. In the upper left-hand corner is a particle that has a few dots on it. That is simply a sedimentary particle or any kind of a sediment that we find in the natural environment. And the dots on that particular particle, we simply say are adsorbed materials. Now this could be bacteria, and E. coli likes to adsorb to surfaces. It could be nutrients, it could be organic compounds or various kinds of things. Now usually in aquifers, the organisms that live in aquifers do not require high nutrient levels. It's the pathogenic organisms that require the high nutrient levels. So if the nutrient levels are increased, we get nucleation, moving from A to B. More nutrients, better conditions, and the pathogens start to compete against the native organisms in the aquifer. Now, two things can happen. If the nutrients continue, as in the case of Waterton, from the nitrogen and phosphorus from the manure, the temperatures are warm, and the particles are being washed in, two things can happen. One is we can get a clustering of these organisms with their food supply, their little nursery, their little home, building up very, very rapidly. Or we can get a complete precipitation of these extracellular compounds around the whole particle. These are called biofilms. It's very similar to the phenomenon that is occurring in your mouth when you have plaque on your teeth. It's exactly the same process. I'm sorry, Jan, you can... It is exactly the same process. Now, what this does is the fact that by having this polymeric film on the outside of these particles, other organisms can get embedded and be protected from outside influences. At the same time, nutrients are there, moisture conditions are right, temperature is correct, so the organisms are building up and they're being protected. We know now that even E. coli, for example, can live up to 6 months in these kinds of films. And E. coli and other organisms are immune or largely immune to such things as chlorination, ultraviolet radiation, and antibiotics. So these are the kinds of things that bind particles, and this is a common phenomenon throughout nature. We've done a study here, and one of our students is in the audience this evening, Suzanne. Suzanne has done a study for us where she looked at a particular ecosystem, and we call this the nursery. We have three components here. And we have the water column and the sediment, and in between the water column and the sediment is a murky layer. This is the kind of murky layer you often see when you fly out of the Vancouver airport and you look at the Fraser entering the ocean, that murky layer all the way over sometimes to Vancouver Island. Suzanne did an analysis of the bacteria, heterotrophic bacteria, and she found about 2,000 colony-forming units in the water, somewhere around 1 to 3 million colony-forming units in the sediment, which was buried, but in these flocks, this material that we just finished talking about, between 33 and 120 million colony-forming units. So you can see that this is a very important nursery for organisms. The conditions for growth then, as we've indicated, an aqueous environment, pH range 5 to 8, precisely what happened in Waterton, it's a limestone terrain. Adequate oxygen. Some organisms, such as E. coli, can live both under aerobic and anaerobic conditions. They can starve and they can still be viable. They had a substrate, they had a home, a nursery, the absorptive surface. They had nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus coming from the manure, and nice, cozy, warm temperatures. If we take a look at the contaminants of water, we have four categories. These are not new. We've known these for many, many years. The bacteria, some of these I'm sure are familiar to you. Salmonella, for example, there are about 1,700 species of Salmonella, and occasionally we hear a breakout of that. Shigella is a very common genera of bacteria, very common in the Middle East and in Asia. E. coli, of course, is a very common organism in the intestinal tract of most mammals. And some of the other ones are not as well known as Pseudomonas, for example, and Clostridium are known as anaerobic bacteria. We have a number of protozoa, which are also common in water. The two common ones, which you've had outbreaks in British Columbia, are Giardia and Cryptosporidium. These are usually not a problem. They can be filtered out, but Cryptosporidium apparently is immune to chlorination. We do have viruses, a variety of viruses. We know a little less about viruses. They're very tiny. They do not reproduce outside of living tissue, so consequently, there has to be some living tissue for these to be able to grow and multiply in contrast to the bacteria. Some of the ones that are common to us are the rotavirus, which I'm sure you've heard about being spread by fleas on rats and mice. You've also probably heard about hepatitis and a common one, the polio virus. The last group are essentially the worms, the tapeworms and so on, which we normally don't worry about because we do filter our water. Now, Walkerton, a unique situation. This has happened before. Here's an example of a Shigella outbreak in Israel. This happened in 1989. Very similar conditions to what happened in Walkerton. Presumed contamination date, about the 17th or 18th of March. First clinical symptoms, about the 19th of March. Walkerton was 12 and 18. Isolated pathogen, the Shigella organism. Colony-forming units, greater than 100. Large areas affected in Israel. Total population, about 1,200 people, of about 70,000 in Walkerton, about 1%. Of the population of 5,000. Prior to the outbreak, heavy rain, in this particular case, a total of about 90 millimeters. Groundwater from the natural springs, same as well, number 5. And of course, the karstic topography, identical topography to what we have in Walkerton, and a similar pumping rate. What happened just prior to this particular outbreak was, again, a rainfall event after a drought period, a strike occurred, so people were not on the site. The chlorine valves were turned off. The well water became contaminated, and we had an outbreak. Almost identical in sequence to what happened at Walker. As I've indicated, this is not new. We think that all of these issues are new, but in fact, this is not new. We know that in 2000, before the Common Era, we found that exposure to sunlight would purify water. So people have been worried about water and disease for a long period of time. The Persians, you can see, started boiling water as early as 600 before the Common Era. Filters and cisterns and boiling of water and distillation of water went through the 18th century, the 15th century, and during the 1800s. We removed a lot of milestones in between there. You'll notice that 1855, Snow first demonstrated that cholera was spread by contaminated water. And of course, dysentery and all these other diseases after that. You see that the first permanent chlorination plant started in Belgium in the early 1900s, and by 1941, almost all the drinking water in the United States was chlorinated. Why? We'll talk about the natural system, but let's look at the human system. We started off our presentation by saying that water is a common resource, important for everyone, but no one really cares as what we do with it. If we look at this particular diagram, on the left-hand side, the upper part, you'll see governments. They're in charge for legislation, guidelines, developing guidelines by which we should manage this particular resource. On the right-hand upper side, we see communities. What they're mainly concerned about is needs, and anything that they can do to get the water as the cheapest possible way, they will do. Stakeholders, various stakeholders, community groups, and so on, try to manage this precious resource in a way that they feel is equitable. And the purveyors, their job is to deliver the water. Now, we would think that with knowledge, that the uncertainty, as knowledge increases, the uncertainty would decrease. But because of this human system and the complexity of our management, in fact, the uncertainty increases.
Now, when you look at the global situation, we have two main sources of microorganisms. One is the human population, and the other one is the animal population. And if you look at the globe today, we have about 6 billion people. And if you take all the agricultural animals and you convert them into livestock units, you end up with about 3 billion livestock units equivalent. We can do this by simply taking chickens and goats and pigs and convert them into livestock units. This is possible through genetic engineering. Well, of course, what we do is we measure the nitrogen content in the waste and then convert it into livestock units. Well, if we do that, we have 3 billion livestock unit equivalents. Now, you have to remember that a typical cow produces about 6 to 7 times as much nitrogen as a human being. So if you convert this, this means the animals produce the same way, the equivalent waste of 18 billion people. So 3 times as much as we have for human beings. Now, in most of the urban environment, we do treat the human waste, but we don't treat the animal waste. We simply dispose it on the land, and we hope that the soils and the environment and the microorganisms will take care of it. Well, let me show you a little bit what happens here. A typical feedlot in Alberta now has somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 animals. So if you convert that into people, that's equivalent to about 300,000 to 600,000 people. That's quite a big city. Now, what do we do with this manure? Because it contains a lot of water, we can't ship it very far, it's too expensive and it smells. So we dispose it wherever we can at the shortest distance from the homestead. Now, we have to start looking at water in the context of hydrological cycling. Now, there are only 2 natural resources which are really mobile, air and water, and the difference is simply that air is pretty evenly distributed. However, water is not. And so when we deal with water, we have a complication. We get the water from precipitation. Some of it is intercepted by vegetation, but a lot of it is transpired back. Some of it gets stored in lakes and rivers and runs off into rivers. And of course, quite a lot of it goes into soils and groundwater and eventually appears somewhere either in the lower part of watersheds or in oceans and places like that. So what we really need to look at is, where does the water actually come from? How much do we actually have? How much do we need? And how do we keep it clean? These are big challenges. And I want to just look very briefly on where do we get our drinking water from? Well, in most cases, we either get it from lakes, from reservoirs, or from streams. Some people collect rainwater, and they drink the water which they collect from their roof runoff. Very typical case in many of the developing countries, where you just collect it into a cistern, and then you use this for the rest of the world, for a year. Groundwater, on the other hand, is this mystery here. And groundwater is quite complicated because whatever we do at the surface has an impact on groundwater, sooner or later. But there are some things which are easier to contaminate than others. We have these layers, like this layer particularly here, where we have a fairly coarse surface material and then maybe a gravel deposit. So whatever we do here goes through here very rapidly and then accumulates in here. These we call unconfined aquifers. And then we might have a big clay layer here, or a limestone layer, or a dense material, which absorbs a lot of the pollutants, and so this can't be penetrated very easily. And then you have a protected layer. So if you drill your well into this, you're in a confined aquifer, is usually much safer than in an unconfined aquifer. So let's have a quick look at how much water do we actually have. If you look at all the freshwater resources and all the hydrological cycle resources, 97.5% is actually in the ocean. You can't really use it very easily. And only about 2.5% is actually freshwater. And unfortunately of that, about 2/3 is in glaciers. So if we then look at the freshwater, 76% of all the freshwater is in glaciers. And 24% is actually in the groundwater. And only less than 0.09% is actually the surface water which we have direct access to. A very tiny, tiny amount. Now, if you look at every country in the world and you look at how many freshwater resources they have, and you convert that in a per capita value, you'll find that we have a lot of countries which are water-scarce countries. These are countries where there is less than 1,000 cubic meters per person per year available to the population. And you can see most of these countries are semi-arid countries in the Middle East. And then we have the water-stressed countries. Those are countries where they have less than 1,600 cubic meters per person per year. And the blue line tells you what the situation was in 1995, and the red line tells you what it's going to be in 2025. And here you are with very interesting company here. Have you ever thought of the United Kingdom of being a water-stressed country? I have never heard of it. But when you start looking at the population and the amount of freshwater resources which are available, that country is in trouble. Let's look at Canada. Canada is actually very fortunate. We have about 8.7% of all the freshwater resources on Earth. It's enormous. But it's very unevenly distributed. In fact, 50% of all of our freshwater actually flows to the north. And the Americans really want to get our water because we only give them about 5% of our fresh water, which flows naturally to the south. Everything else goes east and west. So let's have a quick look at how much do you actually need. The World Health Organization tells us that you should drink about 5 liters of water every day, and you shouldn't use more than about 20 liters for sanitary services and bathing, 15 liters. So roughly, for your daily life, you would need about 50 liters of water per day. Let's see how much the animals actually need. Here's the developing countries' animal water requirements, and here's the developed countries' water requirements. And the typical milk cow needs about 3 times as much as you do. And some of the other ones a bit less, but we can say most of the animals need more water than you do. And then we have to start looking at how much water do we actually need to grow a crop. So if you look at 1 kilogram of rice or 1 kilogram of wheat or 1 kilogram of potato, you need about 1,000 liters per kilogram of food. That's quite a large amount. So let's think now for a moment, how much water would you actually need to maintain your daily diet? What you eat in one day, how much water do you think would be required in order to achieve this lifestyle? Well, in North America, we need about 5,000 liters per day per person to maintain your lifestyle. That is a huge quantity. And you can see in the developing world, it's about half, which means we have a lot of room to reduce, and we have to help this part of the world to increase. Let's have a quick look at how much we actually consume. Here are some statistics on daily consumption in liters per day per person. And you can see the North Americans are the biggest water guzzlers in the world. We drink or use somewhere between 300 and 350 liters per day, while most other countries get by with about half of this. Well, this is bad news in one way, but it's good news in another way, because it means we have a lot of opportunities to go on a water smart program and reduce our water uses to save resources for other uses. Let me show you what happens here in the Vancouver area. This picture here tells you what the GVRD supplies. About more than half of the water actually goes for residential purposes, and only about 6% goes for industry. And in the Lower Fraser Valley, we use only 1% of our fresh water for agriculture. Now, this is totally different from the rest of the world. The rest of the world uses about 2/3 of all the fresh water for agriculture, and the residential part is only 10%. Now, if we project this forward, given the fact that right now 50% of all the people on Earth are in cities, and it is forecasted that within the next 15 years, this will go up to 70%. So if we use 3/4 of all the water for agriculture and everybody is moving into the city, we're going to have a much greater demand for water from the urban environment, and this can only come from trade-offs with agriculture. And if you look at this, these are the projections. This is the 1990 figure, and this is the projection for 2025. So we're seeing that agriculture will have to give up water, have to become more efficient, because the demand for urban water use is increasing, and so is the demand for industrial water use. Whatever we do on Earth has an impact on water. And it doesn't matter whether you're involved in forestry and you want to harvest trees. Whenever you do that, you change the surface conditions, and that alters the water quantity and the water quality. If you're more interested in water-based recreation, that has an impact. If you're involved in agriculture, agriculture has a huge impact on water, both in terms of quantity and quality. If we deal with urbanization, like waste disposal, we have lots of impacts on the water resources. So it doesn't matter what you look at. All of us, whatever activity we do, has an impact. Urbanization. What do? When we urbanize, well, we create stormwater runoff, we create domestic wastewater, we create industrial discharge, we have accidental spills, we create a lot of solid waste, we have atmospheric pollutants which get washed into the system, and we, of course, need water. And all of these things impact water in very different ways by either changing the nutrient content or by changing the temperature. All of these conditions are conducive to bacterial growth. Agriculture does the same thing. If we intensify agriculture, we irrigate, we add more chemicals and nutrients, we create nutrient imbalances, we reduce the organic matter, we get erosion, we have salinity problems. All of these conditions affect water quantity and quality. And even forestry. If we harvest trees, we change the conditions, we then affect the water flow, and we affect stream temperature. Again, the temperatures become warmer. Again, the conditions are conducive to bacterial growth. So what I foresee is a real interesting conflict between agriculture and urbanization. We have to increase our food production by about 50% over the next 15 years because of global population growth. And agriculture is using 3/4 of the water. And urbanization is increasing at a tremendously rapid rate. So there has to be trade-offs. And this will be a big challenge because both urbanization and agriculture have huge impacts on water. Just to give you an example on nearby, what we do in forestry, which is not very nice in some cases, Here's the Sunshine Coast. We create a lot of logging roads, and subsequently we create a lot of landslides. We generate sediments, and these sediments are very conducive to bacterial activity. Here's another picture of Jones Lake. This is a reservoir by BC Hydro. You can see very obvious impacts by logging, creating all this sediment, which of course is a wonderful nursery for bacterial activity.
Our common approach to most of these issues is end of the pipe treatment. This is an example of a sewage treatment plant. We collect our affected water, we take it to a very expensive plant, expensive first of all to construct in capital costs and very expensive to maintain, but it's our typical end of the pipe solution, not source control, but end of the pipe. We have a large number of difficulties with this kind of thing, although it's very useful, and you'll notice from this particular diagram that when we look at the sources of the organisms that may contaminate water, the sewage treatment plant has in fact been very, very successful. When we look at the output of cells of microorganisms per 100 milliliters, you'll notice that the sewage treatment plant is very, very efficient, although costly. It's more efficient than a natural spring or clean water, but look at the contaminated water that went in, greater than 1,000 cells per 100 milliliters. Now, how do we keep our water clean? If we take a look at the various kinds of pathogens and where they come from, the little table in the bottom part of the slide on the board shows the number of fecal coliforms, which E. coli is one of, as well as some other fecal organisms, and this happens to be streptococci, and you've probably heard of streptococci recently in the news as well. About 15% of us have it in our throats. If you take a look at this, the human population, if you take a look at the ratio between fecal coliforms and fecal streptococci, is about 4. If we go to sheep, it's about 0.6, but take a look at cows and hogs. A tremendous amount of streptococci. So it's not sufficient just to monitor for E. coli. We have to be able to monitor for a variety of organisms depending on the source of where that contamination is coming from. Again, the factors that we have to consider are, what is the pH? Remember, Walkerton, we said 5 to 9. Here it's 4 to 9. We have to count both kinds of organisms on the same sample. We have to worry about downstream effects and pollution effects. And these occur very quickly, often within 24 hours, as the case of Walkerton and also as the case of Israel. Fecal coliforms, again, are only a surrogate or an indicator of what is happening. Well, one of the answers that a lot of people have talked about is that we will use bottled water. And this is probably one of the greatest myths that has been perpetrated in the...
How many of you drink bottled water? You're all too embarrassed to admit it, right? And how many of you have the audacity to drink French bottled water? We'll tell you a story about this in a moment.
If you take a look at the graph on the top part of the screen, we have plotted along there from 1984 or 85 to 1999 the total amount of sales of bottled water in the United States. It's become quite staggering. I remember coming to Vancouver many years ago, and it was very difficult to find bottled water in any store, and now we have rows and rows of bottled water. What are the advantages of bottled water? Well, it's filtered, so remove the particles. That's a good idea. It's usually kept cold, and of course we all know that cold is good, otherwise we wouldn't have refrigerators. That's why we have refrigerators and freezers, so that food doesn't spoil and bacteria don't grow. And of course it's a perception by advertising that, of course, that it's safer and better. What are the problems? Well, our normal water supply is tested at least once a day, if not 3 or 4 times a day. Health Canada requires that bottled water be tested at least once every 3 years. Protozoa and selected microorganisms love to live in this water, particularly if it's mineral water, right? It's got surfaces. And as soon as you open it, of course, nice temperatures. plastic containers that hold the water are some of the cheapest plastics available, and a lot of the products in these plastics are soluble, such things as nonylphenols, which are now considered to be very important endocrine disruptors. And this goes into our bottled water. And as the World Wildlife Fund for Nature has indicated, we pay about 1,000 times more for bottled water than for tap water. So we wonder if that is a solution.
Now you probably wonder whether Waukatan could happen here and where our water actually comes from. You are right now, right here at UBC. Here's Stanley Park. Here is Burns Bog. And here's the Fraser River. Now, many of the communities in the upper part of the valley get their drinking water from groundwater. Here is Chilliwack. And almost all the water that people drink in Chilliwack is groundwater. Same in Abbotsford, which is right here. Same in Langley. And we in Vancouver are actually very fortunate because we have three big reservoirs up here, and somebody had the wisdom to fence them all off and don't allow anybody in it. That's a luxury which nobody has. We're working in a watershed in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, where we have 600,000 illegal squatters in the water supply area of the city with no services. Now, this is a luxury which is phenomenal. The only problem we have to consider in the Vancouver watershed is we have sometimes a few landslides, and we have a few wildlife, and both of these things contribute to bacterial problems, sediments being the particles, the nucleus, and wildlife being the store for the microorganisms. So let's have a quick look at what we're actually doing in the Lower Fraser Valley. We calculated how much nitrogen we're applying to the soil surface in all the communities from Vancouver to Hope. And what we did is we said, let's find out how much fertilizer and how much manure is being applied to the agricultural land, and how much do the plants actually need. And if we're very precise, we should have no surplus or no deficit. And then what we said, well, if we have a surplus, what happens to this surplus? It's not needed by the plants. It will sooner or later find its way to the water system. So what I'm showing you here is the surplus of nitrogen in kilograms per hectare per year, which is being applied above what the plants need. And for those of you not familiar, a typical corn crop would need about 150 kilograms per hectare per year to grow. So if you look at the yellow and brown areas here, we typically apply twice as much in what we need, and of course that's going to contaminate your water sooner or later. Now we can look back to 91, and then we can look at the changes, and we can see that in some areas we have been reducing the surplus in green, but in many other places we're still increasing the surplus. And as we intensify our livestock numbers, we're going to increase the manure, so we're going to increase the surplus. So, of course, that's a concern because livestock creates manure. But livestock also requires water. And a very interesting thing is that livestock uses massive amounts of water. Just to give you an idea, if you eat 1 kilogram of chicken, that requires somewhere between 3,500 and 5,500 liters of water to produce. And if you are a beef eater, you need somewhere between 15,000 to 70,000 liters for a kilogram of meat. So as we go into more meat consumption, our water demand is going up. But let's have a quick look at what we're doing in terms of agricultural intensification in the Fraser Valley. Here are the latest numbers. They're about 96 numbers. We have about 125,000 cattle. We have 12,000 sheep and so on. We have 11 million chickens. And we have lots of turkeys. Some are political turkeys, but these are the animal turkeys. And if you convert all of these into livestock unit equivalents, you end up with about 250,000 livestock unique equivalents. Now remember I told you animals generate between 6 and 7 times as much nitrogen, so this is equivalent for 1.5 million people. So this is almost equivalent to the population which we have in the Lower Fraser Valley. And we have just spent $700 million to treat your human waste from primary to secondary treatment. We don't treat the nitrogen yet. And here we have this equivalent amount of waste coming from animal production, which is not treated. So of course, this gives us food for thought, and we have to start thinking about what we're going to do with all this. Another picture which is interesting is we use a lot of pesticides. And here's the pesticide pictures. Now here we can't do a mass balance, but what we do is dollars expended per hectare per year. And you can see we spend a lot of money on pesticides down here, but we don't spend too much up here. And if you looked at nitrogen, the nitrogen surplus is actually up here and not down here. Why this difference? Well, we don't like to spray too much pesticide onto the animals, but we like to spray the pesticide onto berries, cranberries, blueberries, vegetables, and all that kind of stuff. And you can see the evidence here. We're spending much more money on this activity here, where we don't have very many animals.
Well, we've talked about sources of contamination, particularly nitrogen. We've also indicated that all of these kinds of activities, one way or the other, get eventually into the groundwater, our aquifer systems. In addition to the natural sources and the anthropogenic sources, we talked about agriculture, there are many other sources, such as our transportation corridors, our service stations, and all of our other kinds of activities. So what is important is not the individual kinds of activities, but how these various individual activities essentially come together within that hydrologic cycle. An example of where we can illustrate some of these cumulative effects is the Hoppington Aquifer, which is a small watershed in the salmon, is a salmon watershed on the Salmon River in the township of Langley. This is a glacial marine outwash station somewhere around 6,000-7,000 and largely septic tanks. The main activity here is animal, but of course not cows. In this particular case, it happens to be horses. Now, if we take a look at this particular watershed, the provincial government has a ranking system, and you'll notice on the left-hand side, we go from about 1 over to 21, and this is a ranking system. The higher the number, the more vulnerable the aquifer is to contamination and to problems. And if we take a look now at the red ratings on the right-hand side of that diagram, you'll notice that in terms of productivity, vulnerability, and so on, all the important considerations, the Hoppington Aquifer is very vulnerable. If we take a look at the aquifer, the first thing we'll notice is that superficial geology and the soils are relatively coarse textured. They're glacial fluvial outwash, gravels, and sands. What the students and Hans Schreier has done here is the white outlines the aquifer. And inside that aquifer, what we have are, in this particular case, is this
one is septic.
Every little dot there indicates a septic tank. Okay, so you'll notice the dots in that particular watershed. Most of the dots are septic tanks, and there are a few black areas. On top of that, we plot the number of farms. The farms appear as yellow squares. So we plot that same thing on the aquifer boundaries, the white boundary. After that, we've plotted the number of horse farms onto that same geographical base. And then we put them all together. And where you see the green is where all of these activities come together in terms of adding nitrogen in this particular case. Only the black areas are not affected. And this is one of our most vulnerable aquifers in the Lower Fraser Valley.
So we can then again do a nitrogen balance. We can measure how much manure, how much fertilizer nitrogen, how much septic system nitrogen, and how much atmospheric nitrogen goes onto the surface of this aquifer. we can then calculate how much the crops are taking up and how much is lost through atmospheric release. And then we want to find out whether we have a surplus. So let's have a look here at the surplus. Now, anything which is blue, green, or yellow is relatively low inputs. So you can see hobby farms don't contribute a very much surplus nitrogen. Commercial farms a little bit, but not excessively. Septic systems, again, a little bit. But then when we put it all together, that's when we have cumulative effects. So we're actually applying about 18% of all the surplus comes from septic, from hobby farms, about half from commercial farms, about a third comes from septic systems. And so what this really points out is we're all part of the problem. And we can then verify this by actually doing groundwater analysis. So we went to 80 households and tested their water, and here are the results. And the results show that anything which is red is above 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen. Now we have a standard, and the standard is 1 milligram is excellent, 10 is the health standard, because above that you have the blue baby syndrome problem. And this is interesting because 2 years ago, the European Economic Community decided they require the bottle companies to put their nitrate values onto the bottles. And remember, 1 is excellent and 10 is terrible. And most of the streams, if they're unpolluted, have no more than 1 or 2 milligrams of nitrogen. And guess what? 3 companies couldn't meet the 10 milligram standard. And good old Perrier and Evian came out with about 5 to 6 milligrams of nitrate nitrogen, which isn't a health hazard, but doesn't bode very well for having really clean water. Some of these companies actually had to buy the land from the aquifer which they used the water from. They had to buy the land to reduce the inputs. And that gives you a bit of an idea that if you buy bottled water in Vancouver, you are rather foolish, because it isn't better, and it's at least 100 to 1,000 times more expensive.
Now, just very briefly, we'll also talk about some of our other activities here. We're driving our SUV, and as I'm sure you can see, out the back end comes a bunch of hydrocarbons, lead and manganese. As we drive along, put on our brakes, as we scour along through our catalytic converters, our mufflers, our brakes, and so on, we're also putting in copper, zinc, and chromium into the environment. And of course, acid rain is coming down from industrial activities that have occurred elsewhere. And of course, fossil fuel is going into the tank. Now, what we've done since the 1970s, we've removed lead from gasoline in Canada, and as an substitute, we've had a substitute technology, we've substituted manganese for lead as the anti-knock agent. Here's a study done by some of the people in the Institute which showed the lead concentration in the Burnett watershed in 1973 and also in 1993. And you'll notice that the yellow bars are very high and of course have now decreased. The lead is in yellow concentrations. Now, if we take a look at the manganese, the same sites, lead has gone down and manganese has gone up. So we've traded one heavy metal for another. And this is what we consider, how important we consider our aquatic resources. We dump contaminants directly into them. We throw hydrocarbons directly into them from urban sprawl. Many places we don't even treat our sewage. Acid mine drainage, which is probably a very important issue. We don't worry too much about it, particularly if the water drains because it goes out of sight. And of course, we can see all of our wetlands as well being affected. Let's go back to Walkerton and let's talk about the Lower Fraser Valley aquifers. Shallow soils, yes. One case, karst topography or limestone, an impervious layer. We have the same thing in the Lower Fraser Valley as a result of glaciation. Shallow depth to groundwater, yes, within 10 meters. High livestock densities, yes. rural to suburban communities, prone to dry, warm weather, at least in the Lower Fraser Valley, we have prone to dry weather, possibly not warm.
So what have we done traditionally? Well, we've expanded our supplies. Every time the population moves further out into the valley, we extend the pipes and we look for new water resources. We've been very successful in draining many wetlands. In fact, in North America, we've drained about 60% of all the wetlands because we want to use it for other purposes. We have minimized all the buffer zones around rivers because in an urban environment, people tell you that the land is so expensive, we can't give you a big corridor of vegetated surface which can trap the sediments, and so we have minimized the buffer zones. We've been very successful in piping everything from stormwater to drinking water to wastewater, and we pipe it directly into the stream to get rid of it. We have been very successful at end-of-pipe treatment. We have industrial treatment is quite effective. We have mainly focused on these industrial point sources, and we've been quite effective there. We created lots of impervious surfaces. Every parking lot has to be paved so that you can walk and drive in a smooth manner. Well, whatever happens when you create an impervious surface, you don't let the water penetrate to the soil and it doesn't get cleaned. Instead, it washes right into the stream. We've also dealt mostly with single pollutants. We look at nitrogen, we look at lead, we look at individual pollutants, we very rarely look at multiple pollutants. And we have always dealt with single water supplies. We either deal with one groundwater aquifer or we deal with one source. And what we really need to do is we have to be innovative. We have to start thinking about controlling the water demand. If we reduce our water consumption by 10 or 15%, you wouldn't even notice the difference. But this has huge cost implications. We can reduce the cost dramatically. We're now in a process of creating wetlands because we're finding that wetlands are wonderful systems which not only trap sediments, but they actually purify all kinds of pollutant conditions. So we now actually create wetlands in urban environments to filter out the nurseries of the bacteria. We're now trying to create new buffer zones, maximizing buffer zones around stream systems so that the sediments can be trapped before they get into the stream and the nutrients can be taken up by the plants. We're now no longer piping the stormwater directly into the stream. We're trying to create detention ponds and let the water filter through the soil into the stream. We now not only talk about end-of-pipe treatment, but we're talking about source control. If we can reduce the inputs at the source, we have much less problems at the end of the pipe. The big challenge is non-point source pollution. You and me and everybody else, we all contribute a little bit. And as an individual, it's not very much, but cumulatively, it's quite bad. So we have to focus on these non-point sources. We have to start minimizing impervious surfaces. We have all kinds of technology to create pervious parking lots. And we have to start addressing cumulative effects. And of course, we should no longer look at single supplies. We should look at the watershed framework, because whatever we do in the headwaters is going to affect everybody downstream. And just to show you typically what we've been doing in terms of wetlands, we have drained these wetlands so we can use them. And now we're going back to recreate them. And this is a very important activity which has tremendous environmental benefits, and we're learning how to do this. But it's much easier to drain a wetland. It's much more complex to create one, specifically if you want to create one to a certain specification.
Well, to start to summarize, what do we know? Well, we know that natural processes are not separate. They operate in an interconnected way. Anything we touch has effects on other aspects of the system. Systems have fixed capacities to absorb our impacts. Well, if we exceed those particular resiliences or capacities, we end up with surprises at Walkerton. Human systems, our institutions, are not connected to our natural systems. Our human institutional systems looks at one thing at a time with a particular vested interest. We need to connect natural systems and human systems. One of the ways we call now integrated watershed management. In the impacts of individual activities are small, as illustrated in a number of our illustrations this evening. Combined, they provide cumulative effects and often things that we don't know. One of the things which we call the precautionary principle, if in doubt of your activity, don't do it. What can we do? Water is vital and needs to be looked at as a system, the hydrologic cycle. So we have to manage water in the watershed context. If it integrates everything in the watershed, we have to manage the watershed, not a single well. We have to recognize that we all contribute to water quality, and the cumulative effects are the rule. So we should be reducing our wastes. Environmental issues are complex. Our knowledge is incomplete. We have to quit being arrogant about the way we treat our environment. Guidelines, best management practices, and legislation must recognize systems, thus move towards integrated watershed management rather than sectoral approaches. Fisheries separate from mining, separate from agriculture, separate from forestry, they all affect water quality. We have to get people involved in environmental issues, particularly issues such as water, a substance without which we cannot live. And we have to move towards minimizing waste generation. Simply, there is no a way to. We can throw anything. It comes back.
So here are your 10 commandments. We have to increase education and awareness about water.
We have to control demand, water smart.
We have to work in a watershed context.
Focus on source, prevention, and treatment.
We have to create integration between earth science, medicine, and social sciences.
Decision making, setting of policy must reflect our best knowledge.
We have to share water amongst all the users. Remember, we need drinking water, we need water for agriculture, for hydro, for recreation, aquatic biota, and environmental services. And most of these are in conflict, and we have to learn how to share.
Although all of our tech activities will always affect water, there will always be pollution, we should work towards zero pollution because of the cumulative effects, and we should not be setting standards as to maximizing the amount of pollution we can put in water, but we should be working towards zero pollution and taxing pollution above that.
And I recommend that you go home and hug a microorganism, because we have to work with them, rather fight with them, because they're everywhere.
And remember, there are unknowns, the so-called joker. Climate change, we're not sure what's going to happen with our precipitation regimes, temperature regimes. This is going to give us a lot more unknowns in the future. So it's a joker. So if we don't have it in our back pocket, it's liable to come out and hurt us. To answer the question we were asked, Walkerton, could it happen here? We believe the evidence of human actions, based on our reluctance to place a priority, socially that is, on environmental resources and our unwillingness to mold our institutions in concert with nature and the way systems are interconnected in nature, and our tendency to react to problems rather than to proact, unfortunately, the answer is probably yes. Need it happen here? We believe no, it does not have to happen here. Or at least if it does happen here, the impact will be much less devastating than it has been in other places, such as at Walkerton. Should it happen, we can decrease the impact if we apply our best knowledge. The process is systems thinking. We have to start thinking about humans as being part of the natural cycles and part of the environment. We have to get away from single sector approaches, both in our advocacy and also in our guidelines, legislation, and best management practices. We have to communicate amongst all of us. We have to have a willingness to accept all of these kinds of changes because without Environmental Services water, the future is in question.
Thank you very much.
The question was, the changes that the Liberal government have made in the last few months, have this increased the chances of a Walkerton happening? That's a difficult question to answer. I guess it's really unknown, because if we take a look at Walkerton, one of the issues was a lot of human error. People were negligent, they did not care. They did not put in the continuous monitoring systems that would have monitored the chloride content and kept it at 10 milligrams per liter. They falsified records and these kinds of things. So the human error part I cannot comment on. I think from the standpoint of the issues that come up, if we have qualified people that really care, we have the guidelines in place. We have the regulations in place. Do we have the will to enforce it, whether it's the private sector or the public sector? And how we can work those issues out, I don't know. I think the longer term problem is the fact that we still are dealing sector by sector by sector, when we can't do that with something as fluid and as important as water. I'm sorry, I can't give a more precise answer than that. The comment from the audience was that as of September 25th, the Liberal government has weakened the legislation on water quality in the province. Yes?
Our filter at home, such as the Brita that is advertised on television, any use?
The question was, are filters such as Brita filters at home of any use? The answer is yes. They're actually very useful. They take out cryptosporidium, a lot of these other compounds. Absolutely, all the sediment comes out. The big problem is to make sure you change the filters periodically, particularly if they keep them nice and warm. If you have a lot of sediment on your filter, keep them nice and warm, add a little bit of nutrients, and you're going to have a nice little nursery there. But if you change your filters regularly, yes, absolutely. Keep them cold, change them regularly. Absolutely. Yes? You want...
Okay.
I don't. Sorry.
You talked about the agriculture dynamics versus the urbanization dynamics, and then you had the slide that talked about the innovative approaches. But there didn't seem to be any innovation with relation to agriculture. Are there any innovations with regards to the agriculture that can lead to some sort of sustainable, balanced relationship?
Well, agriculture is a big challenge because right now, from an economic point of view, they're not doing very well because it's very hard to make money in agriculture. However, since they're using 3/4 of all the water, they have to become more efficient in terms of the way they use water. And there's some really interesting things happening. We're doing a lot of research with cheap trickle irrigation systems. We just have a graduate student who completed a study in Nepal. We can buy a trickle irrigation system for about $12.50, which will irrigate a plot of 40 by 40 meters. And so we're looking at growing cash crops with absolute minimum amounts of water. And this technology is now cheap enough that it can be widely used in the third world. And also, there is a lot of effort now. The farmers know that if they have the water right, they can actually get money for the water they are going to give to this city. And so they can convert that into more efficient systems. So there's a lot of options there in terms of how agriculture uses the water. And I'm quite positive that this will happen. What I'm not so positive about is the way we treat the waste. And I think that is going to be the big, big issue, because North America has done an incredible effort trying to sell meat to the rest of the world, because now everybody eats chicken burgers and hamburgers. Even in countries like India, which is not known to be a meat-eating country, they all of a sudden are eating chicken burgers. And that, of course, means lots of manure generated. And we're going to have to come to grips in the way we deal with manure. We can no longer deal with it like we did in the past in a family farm setting. Denmark, for example, has very strict regulations. They say 2.5 livestock units per hectare is the carrying capacity of the land. So if a farm has 20 animals, he has to have sufficient amount of land to dispose of the manure. That's totally contrary to what we do in North America with our big feedlots. So we have to regulate feedlots like we regulate the industry. They're going to have a waste disposal site and deal with it.
Bert?
My question was precisely the comparison between the feedlots and the range production of chickens, livestock, pigs, etc. in the developing world, and what impact that is having on water use as compared with this industrial concentration. Do you have any figures to illustrate?
Yeah, the question is, what is happening to all these feedlot or this intensification of agriculture in the third world, and how that is affecting the water in the third world? Well, the problem right now is we're recognizing in the developed world that these feedlots generate a lot of waste, so we're investing heavily in the third world to do it there so that they have to deal with the waste. If you look at Taiwan, Taiwan is one of the most polluted countries in the world because they industrialized very heavily. And now all of their meat operations have been seconded into the Philippines and places like that. And they're big pig feedlots and so on, which are creating huge environmental problems. And for the developing countries, this is a big issue because it's opportunities to get into the cash market. But at the same time, it's the waste problem. Now, it's very interesting. In Europe now, they have passed a law that you can export meat, but you cannot export the waste. And this has created some huge headaches for Holland. In fact, in Holland, they had a big parliamentary session for 5 days talking about how to deal with the shit policy. Because it's basically the problem of how do you deal with pig manure, and when you export about a third of all the production, and you have to deal with the waste, and you have to basically, the only drinking water in Holland comes either from groundwater or from water from rivers which are recharging the groundwater. And so they're struggling with this. They're doing some innovative things, but it's not going to be an easy process. And this is now a global problem everywhere you go. It's not only in Canada, it's not only in the US. If you want to hear a real horror story, North Carolina is probably the biggest horror story I know of. Remember a year and a bit ago, there was a big hurricane. Well, North Carolina was very, very successful to lobby for subsidies for transport of animals and for heating of livestock operations. So they produce about 20 to 25% of all the pigs in North America. And some of the pig lagoons, nobody likes pig manure for obvious reasons, and some of the pig lagoons are the size of football fields. And then this big hurricane came and flooded the whole coastal zone. And all of this stuff went all over the beach, and for the last 8 to 10 months, nobody has gone to the beach for recreational purposes for obvious reasons. So these are problems which we have to start to address in a global context. And yes, there is huge impacts from these kind of activities in the third world.
Jan?
Yes, I noticed that in North America, water consumption per capita is about 3 times what it is in Europe. Now, as European jurisdictions that I'm familiar with have all the households have all water meters. What, and this is apparently an issue in the Greater Vancouver what would be the effect or the influence of the installation, mandatory installation of water meters? What would the effect be on water consumption?
Well, lots of studies have shown that if you increase the price by metering it, the consumption goes down quite dramatically. About 20 to 30%, but the problem is it's extremely costly. The city of Helsinki has been trying to do this for the last year and a half, and they have given up because they figure the cost of this is horrendous. But the way to do this is not to simply pass legislation and tell everybody they have to do it. The way to do this is start with any new house which is being built. We should have rules and regulations in any new house which is being built to have low flush toilets, low shower water use shower heads, and have water meters on it. And then over time you can phase it in so you can actually defer all these costs. And I think this is the way to go.
Now, what is it about North Americans that causes them to use so much more water than Europeans?
Well,
Jan, I think the other issue is the fact that we still have a frontier attitude. But if you take a look at the water consumption in Seattle versus Vancouver, Seattle uses about half as much water per capita as we do in Vancouver. So it's not North Americans. It depends on whether the metering is there and what are the regulations in terms of the pricing of water. Water is a commons. We have 8% of the total fresh water on the planet. It's a luxury. We don't have to worry about it.
We just calculated that every household in Vancouver pays about $20 per month for water. And you pay about, what, $30 for your television cable services? So your cable services is more expensive than your water.
More important.
And it's more important, right?
Joe?
Well, we had a little bit of a problem because they're not interconnectable until very recently. We're now building pipes to connect them because one only serves a part of the city and another one another part of the city. And when we have some dry periods, then we get into troubles because one of the reservoirs might be very low and we can't use the other one for that particular area. But this is now being addressed. They are now connecting the pipes which come out of these reservoirs so they can be interchanged. So,
but do they all supply about the same water?
No. The Coquitlam is far the biggest. Capilano is the smallest.
Which is the smallest?
The Coquitlam is the biggest.
Yeah.
The smallest.
And Capilano is the smallest. Yeah. And everybody complains about the Vancouver watersheds, but somebody had the foresight to keep them aside. And I think this will be a very, very wonderful experience for the future because everybody is struggling to find new resources and we have them. And if you have ever had a chance to visit the watersheds, there is a tour on every Sunday in the summer which allows you to see what they're doing and it's quite impressive. So don't believe all the stuff you read in the Sun.
Two more questions, and then there'll be coffee and cookies.
You want to select it? You want to select them? The question was, what about the use of reverse osmosis in what application? Just water clarification?
Just for drinking water. Local store.
Yes.
2 miles away.
Yes, it's becoming more and more popular. It's very popular in the United States. Reverse osmosis is being picked up quite considerably here as well. It works marvelously. Again, the same problem as this gentleman's question. Make sure that you change the filters.
Can I say something about reverse osmosis?
Yes.
If
uses... Sorry, this young lady would like to talk about reverse osmosis.
Okay. My neighbor on Gabriola, because I also have a pipe over there, used reverse osmosis. And it uses, if you're on a well, it uses double the amount of water that you actually get out. Mm-hmm. The end pipe. And so it is, if you're on a well, it's
manganese.
The same heavy metal that California is suing a Canadian company called Methalex, I believe.
Manganese.
Manganese. Yeah.
Over the gasoline additive.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is
yes.
Is that the same one that's
yes.
allowed in our water?
Yeah. Pardon me?
It's allowed in our gas, I'm sorry?
We use it in Canada for our ant. The question was, is manganese the metal that California are suing, or California company is suing Canada for, the federal government for breach of contract, because we're using manganese as our anti-knock agent in our gasoline. That's correct.
That's correct.
E. coli, it's rather interesting. I'm not a microbiologist, but I've read quite a bit about it, and this is in fact one of the hypotheses, is that it is a mutant, and that's why it's given that particular number with the hyphenation 87. E. coli is common in most mammals, including ourselves. This particular one, we believe, is a result of organic compounds, anthropogenic compounds, pesticides or growth hormones or things that have been used in animal feed. This is a major concern that people are having. We did ask one of our microbiologists here on the campus if this particular strain of E. coli was present in wildlife. And apparently it might be in deer, but there has been no work done on it. So that is a big question. This is one of those questions that we, if we're in doubt, let's not.
Yeah, well, my background is.
But you're absolutely right. Sorry?
And my background is microbiology.
Okay. Yes.
And quite prevalent in south of the border.
Yes.
You know, a lot of feedlots.
Yes, and apparently it has something to do with the cattle that are being shipped around. Yes, apparently it is a result of agricultural practices in the feeding of antibiotics and growth hormones and so on. Yes, that's what I hear too, but I can't say for sure.
Well, I think we'll have to wind it up there, and I'll ask Dr. Patricia Marchak, former Dean of Arts at UBC, to thank our speakers.
Thank you.
Well, Hans Schreier and Les Lefkowitz have given us a lot of very disturbing information, even though they've given it in such a very entertaining way. Amongst the things that they've told us to do, or recommended that we do, and that we could do right away, are to reduce our meat consumption, to stop using SUVs, to reduce our use and waste of water, and we might be able to do that by starting to charge ourselves for it, to be very careful about adding any chemicals to our gardens, and if we own farms, obviously to our farms, and put some pressure on governments to maintain better regulations. I'd like to say that as a social scientist, I just found this fascinating. I know that Les, as head of the Institute, has been working very hard trying to get more social scientists involved in working with the scientists on these kinds of issues. And I think that if more social scientists were to start becoming involved, they would see this link between the social sciences and the physical sciences, and the great need for us to work together, because a lot of these problems are social. The results are often physical. So the social scientists in this audience, I hope that you have felt the same as I've felt, that we really have to do more and contribute more to these very important debates that are going on in the Institute for Resources and Environment, which these two gentlemen have done so very much to establish and to bring very good research to this campus. And thank you both very, very much for sharing it with us.
I remind you again, it's coffee and cookies in the foyer just outside.